You are listening to the Enormo Cast.
All right. Settle down, everybody. Settle down. Okay, Black Diamond C4, take it away.
Okay, is this thing on? All right, everybody. I know you have a few questions after a long winter of ice climbing. So, you in the back, the trad dad with the sig.
So it seems like I've had Black Diamond Camelots hanging off my rack since 1987. How you still so high on the horse, boy?
Well, that's called evolution, my dog. BD retools and redesigns on the reg. I'm lighter, stronger, with every upgrade. Huh, too bad we can't say the same about you, huh, Trad Dad?
I can still hand jam.
Okay, who's next? The comp kid who crushes Trad now.
My mom bought me 3 sets of ultralight Camelots.
Well, kid, those ultralights are sweet. Light, fast, smooth, all the things. But not everybody has a mom with a platinum card willing to buy her snookums whatever she wants, now do they? And trust funds don't grow on trees. They come from decades of swindling the general public out of something, maybe even their trees. And who's got time for that? So yeah, ultralights are swell. The Ferraris. But us C4 Camelots, we're down here in the trenches with you every day. Know what I'm saying? Like the cam equivalent of your Tacoma. Just ask the creek climbers over there.
Hell yeah, brother.
Okay, one last question. A guy on the internet that doesn't actually climb.
It says here that a number one C4 holds 12 kilonewtons, while this other brand holds 12.2 kilonewtons. Now, in a situation where a factor 2 occurs after a meteor strike, resulting in an ionic reverse polarity electromagnetic shockwave, the question is, would my quad fail?
Hold on a second, Buckaroo. Have you ever actually placed a cam?
No.
All right, I gotta go. But just remember, there's only one Black Diamond C4 Camelot. We've been here catching you guys the whole time, since the beginning. So quit screwing around and go to blackdiamondequipment.com or a local shop and give us a squeeze. See what you think. Camelots rule, imitators drool. Peace.
Consider the Belayer. Steadfast and sure-footed, the Belayer is a breed apart. Often taken for granted, the Belayer literally saves your life every single time you punt. And let's face it, that's a lot of disasters averted. Loyal and smart, whether it's the first time you've said take or the 100th, the Belayer sits back and holds you right where you want to be while you brush that hold one more time, even though both you and your trusty Belayer know it ain't going to change a goddamn thing. The Belayer just smiles and says,
"Dude, you totally got it next time."
Even though there's no way on God's green earth you will in fact get it next time. So maybe it's time to honor the unsung hero of your journey with a fine gift from Peter W. Gilroy. Peter, a Belayer himself, knows what a trinket or a sweet splitter hat, the ones with the mountain-inspired titanium badges, will do for a worn-out Belayer spirit when you've been riding them hard. Artful jewelry and accessories can be found at peterwgilroy.com for your Belayer or any partner you've been forgetting to appreciate during that singular haze of the next burn. So consider your Belayer and peterwgilroy.com. One day you might look down and they'll be gone, eating that sandwich they've been thinking about since you took on the second bolt an hour ago. And don't forget to enter Enormo at checkout for a discount and to help this darn podcast.
Listen, where are you playing in town? Are you playing here?
We're doing the Enormo Dome, whatever it is. It's terrific.
Oh,
it's
yeah, big place. That's out. Side of town. That's a big nice. Place. You sold
what's
it
that
out.
I'll say,
you really should.
Look, you better get up there before you panic. Those pens are loose.
You're very good. I have really enjoyed climbing with you.
We'll make it.
I don't think so. But we shall continue with style.
Good weather, bad weather. Now or later, anytime for climbing.
Today's show is brought to you by Black Diamond Equipment, La Sportiva, and with support from Maxim Ropes. Maxim has been keeping the Enormo Cast off the deck since 2012.
And now, we can also thank the chill folks at Yeti. And don't forget our charter sponsor, Bonfire Coffee. Go to bonfirecoffee.com and enter Enormo at checkout to get a great deal on great coffee and to support the Enormo Cast.
And now back to the show.
Hello and welcome to the Enormo Cast. This is your host, Chris Calouse. It is April 30th, 2024, about 1:45 in the afternoon, and this is episode 284 of the EnormaCast, a conversation with UK climber Emma Twyford. And I'm sure she's going to cringe at that pronunciation all down here, Twyford. Emma Twyford. But it's too late, Emma. You're on the show. You agreed to do it, and now I'll pronounce your name as I wish. And you don't want me to do a British accent. I don't really do a good British accent, actually. My French accent, much better. I actually worked on that. Not learning French, mind you, just working on the accent. So yeah, Emma's on the show. She is an excellent all-around rock climber and particularly known for her trad climbing. And when we talk about trad climbing in where she lives in North Wales, we're talking about something very specific. Bold, no bolts, small gear, all that stuff. It's something that seems to be only practiced here in North America anymore very infrequently, but it's more of a longstanding tradition in North Wales. But we get into all that in the interview. But before that, I would like to do a PSA for small companies in climbing. Support them. Go out of your way to support them. Okay. I know I've got some big names here running the podcast. That's okay too. You know, you can't really make cams in your garage anymore or really nice shoes like that or anything like that. But there is a place in this world for the small business, and you have to seek them out and you have to go for it and go to these smaller companies. With that in mind, I want to get you hip to Ale. My friend Sonia over there, she's one of the founders, and this is like, you know, kind of climber and outdoor oriented hygiene products and skin body care products, lip balm, salves, lotions, things like that. But they've got this like full body wipe thing that's like a great big wet wipe, but it's sort of gentle and scented. And, you know, it could be like more like refreshing and gentle on your naughty bits. Just in case you're out there for a while and the mood hits. You're up on that portal edge, tired of just staring at the horizon. And, you know, you want to do something else. Like play a game of Uno. You want to be clean for Uno. I think you can clean the rest of your body with it too. It's not necessarily stuff for like training, climbing hard and getting your skin all set up. It's to make you feel good too. It's all at aleoutdoor.com. Sustainably made, sustainably packaged. They give a little bit of each sale to access organizations and or environmental organizations. So it's all good. And you know what? You know, it's not a small company like Burt's Bees. They just pretend. They put the little guy on there with the beard, old Burt. It's a trick. They're tricking you. Okay? They're tricking you with that. Guess who owns Burt's Bees? Clorox, dog. Bleach and lip balm. Perfect. I'm not saying there's bleach in the lip balm. Don't sue me. Anyway, Burt ain't around anymore. He probably lives in Monaco or something. All right. Support climber-owned small businesses like Ale. And this is an unpaid, unaffiliated spray down. Sonia happens to be the special lady friend of my friend and friend of the show, Kelly Cordes. And frankly, all of his friends and Kelly, for that matter, don't have any idea how he ended up with such a classy lady. Okay, speaking of classy ladies, let's get to the interview with Emma Twyford. Just a joy to talk to. Made this happen. She worked really hard to get it done. We had to reschedule at least once because she had a good forecast up there in North Wales. And when you live up there, you can't let that go by. But turned out they got rained on anyway. Did a couple pitches though. Man, tough stuff up there. It's half the reason we admire these people. They get it done despite those conditions. Let's get to it. Emma Twyford. Hey, folks. You know that favorite local shop that I go on about at the end of my ads? Well, I say that because brick and mortar climbing shops have long been the L5 vertebra and the backbone of climbing culture. And now, Sportiva North America has decided to open an old-fashioned but newfangled retail store in Boulder, Colorado. You've heard of Boulder, right? Quaint little town on the front range of the Rockies. By the way, how do you know when a climber is from Boulder? Oh, they'll tell you. Shout out to Rose for that one. Anyway, the new Sportiva store will feature their most popular gear, opportunities to get your grubby hands on discounted equipment, and maybe most importantly, a chance to try on those shoes before you commit. Also, look for coming events as Sportiva gathers the community around climbing's best presenters, writers, and filmmakers. So if you swing through Boulder, and as a climber, you know that you eventually should, check out the new Sportiva retail store on 2100 Broadway and see how it holds up against your own favorite local shop. Tell me about your climbing life at this moment.
Oh, wow.
You know, what's your motivations these days? You've been talking a lot about motivation on Instagram, so maybe that's a good place to start.
I mean, it's always... It goes in ebbs and flows with motivation, and at the moment I'm pretty psyched. I think there's certain I've reached a certain age in life where maybe this is a last year of really going for it before other big things like trying to have kids. But I think the motivation's always there because there's so much variety in the UK, and I've got some more big trad projects this year in North Wales in particular. And also some stuff down at Lower Pentru, and I've got many open projects, basically. It's a never-ending list. This year in particular, I've got things like there's a route called Mission Impossible. It's in North Wales. It's E9. Hazel Finley's climbed it before. It's one I find really hard. I keep on falling off it at the moment. And then just keeping with the sports projects. At the moment, it's been really wet for the last 7 or 8 months in North Wales. So it's just kind of waiting and biding your time for those windows of opportunity when they come, and making sure you're on it as soon as it does come good. The last couple of years have been a bit funny. So my best friend had a really serious car accident about a year and a half ago now. And she ended up brain injured. And she's on the mend now, but it actually really messed with my head and messed with my motivation, and climbing just went to one side until last year, really. And last year I started to get my willingness to try hard come back again and not be scared of falling. The year before I was scared of falling just by a bolt even, which was pretty rare territory for me.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, your trad climbing resume is deep and full of all the things that go with climbing where you climb. Do you think it was, you know, was it just this sort of mortality check? Did you ever dig around and figure out maybe what that accident, you know, which wasn't climbing related in that sense, you know, just caused sort of a general fear in you?
I think it definitely shook me up more than I thought it would. I mean, I've had a car accident myself back in the past. I've had near misses on trad when I was really young. So whether it's a mortality check or not, or that, I'm not sure. I think it was more just all my mental capacity was taken up with spending time with my friend, making sure she was getting better. And I think it was just like a really harrowing couple of months where it was quite draining energy-wise. I mean, she didn't speak for the first 3 weeks. And then her recovery rate, it had its ups and downs. And so I think that took up so much of my mental capacity that when it came to my own personal life and climbing, the mental capacity just wasn't there to have the capabilities to try hard.
Did the sort of, I mean, recovery from that, was it something you did actively, or you know, do you feel like it kind of settled down and shifted as your friend's prognosis got better and things settled down and shifted? Or was it something you had to, you know, work on kind of actively?
I think it was definitely something.
And was Hazel Finley involved in that process at all?
No, but she is friends with the same person.
Okay.
And so I think I had actually a chat with her partner, Angus, where I was like, I'm just not feeling it right now. And there's that definitely that understanding probably between all of us what it's like to go through something like that. And I think I actively went out, and even though I wasn't able to do my projects, I was still going and taking small falls and kind of pushing myself when I could. So I think in hindsight, that fall practice was really beneficial, although it wasn't me sending any of my projects. It was still kind of going out and becoming okay with the fear again and getting used to taking falls and just that being okay, even though it was in my own control. I would just fall off when I didn't feel like I wanted to go any further.
Looking at, again, your sort of recent history, and you've been climbing a long time, actually. I wasn't even sure when we set this up, like, how old you were. And again, having never heard of you, actually, I mean, I had, but not really investigated or understood who you were. It almost felt like, oh, she's this new phenom that I haven't heard of. But then I looked, it's like, no, you're not. You've been around a bit, climbing on this stuff for a while. But also I've noticed, and this probably went hand in hand, and also is like a little bit of aging and things, is that you've talked a bit about, you know, the fact that your performance ebbs and flows as well. And that was something that, you know, you've spent some time thinking about in the last few years. And, you know, I mentioned that history because, you know, again, reading about you on the internet, there was this like this real, you know, kind of push or performance height, you know, in the end of the teens, you know, the 2018, and was mentioned in 2019 climbing 9A. And I know that when you're in those modes, it feels like, well, this is going to go on forever. Like, I'm just getting better and better. And like, this, I send one hard thing, I'll send another harder thing next. And obviously, that's not the case. So, you know, this fear thing and that thing has probably made you sort of reflect on, again, I asked you about like climbing right now today, maybe reflecting on who you are as a climber and where it fits into your life a little bit more. Would that be, I mean, is that something that seems accurate of the last, you know, few months or a couple of years?
Yeah, I think obviously I had the momentum in 2018, 2019, and then lockdown happened.
Yeah, right.
And COVID. So I think all of that momentum that could have carried on just fell by the wayside because we were stuck inside. And
you didn't just go into your cellar and get twice as strong.
I don't actually have a cellar. Don't everyone have
cellars in the UK? Isn't it like a standard issue, like evil board inside of a dark cellar?
I think eventually we will get a cellar, but no, we don't have one yet.
Okay.
But that does seem to be the British.
Yeah.
It's this like dark, dingy. It has to be a cellar. Yep. With some techno,
it's like 5 feet tall.
Yeah.
You can't stand up. Yeah. No. Go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted your serious thought about the pandemic.
Yeah. I had my friend who had the car accident. I was living with her at the time. I'd just gone through a breakup. And so we were training together. We'd like set each other little challenges. We'd do stupid pull-up challenges, one-legged squat challenges. Occasionally we'd get out bouldering close to home, but that was it. And alcohol kicked in a little bit during lockdown. But I think I came out of it not too bad. And like I said, it's just been ebbs and flows since then. I had a pretty scarring experience trying to go and repeat one of Dave McLeod's routes, and it's up in Scotland. It's the longest sea cliff climb, called the Long Hope, which weighs in about E10 or E11. And I went up with a guy called Robbie Phillips. And it's the most chossy climb I think I've ever been on. Like sandstone choss, really bad gear, really snappy rock. And you get these birds called fulmars as well. And they nest with one egg, but they don't actually have a nest. So their protection mechanism is to vomit on you. So you're there trying to think about climbing on snappy rock with bad gear and trying to avoid these birds that want to vomit on you to defend themselves. So it was an interesting experience. I think we got to the penultimate pitch before the last hour pitch, and you have to crawl through a tunnel, or Robbie was trying to crawl through this tunnel. And there were some fulmars nesting, and eventually he retreated and he was like, we just can't go any further. And that weirdly messed with my sight for a little bit, because I went back onto normal trad climbing and didn't trust any of my gear for a while. But then that came back into getting some reasonable routes done after that. It just took a while to become confident that not every hold was going to snap on me and not every piece of gear looked terrible, basically.
Yeah, and it sounds like some of your messaging, if you will, and you have a degree in sports science, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, so you have some deeper background than just personal experience, but it seems like a lot of this has also been
a bit of, I don't know if it's like you'd call it straight self-care or it's almost like self-forgiveness in a way. That's been something that you've sort of preached, this idea that you don't, that you can kind of let yourself feel crummy or, you know, I think you said had a pity party for a little bit.
Yeah, your motivations pretty much.
Go down it. Well, and it's interesting, I think about it, because I mean, we're both in scenes, climbing scenes. I'm a bit out of it, but I've been in scenes where, you know, it's almost like you're worthless if you don't get up every day and want to go climbing. And I think like your, you know, the North Wales scene and kind of some of the crew that you seem to be in with, you know, that is life. You don't waste a day, you don't waste a minute. You try hard all the time, and you know, but secretly, like, none of us can do that. But you know what I mean? Like, you have this like external pressure to do all that. So, you know, what was the realization around some of these ideas that like, it's okay if Emma doesn't climb on this like soggy climb today or whatever it happens to be?
I think it goes through probably all the way back to the start, in that I grew up climbing in the Lake District with my dad on traditional rock climbing. And I think they kind of always instilled this love for climbing from a very young age, and that I could do what I wanted to do. So I competed for a bit. I got glandular fever, decided that comps were no longer for me, and went back to outdoor climbing. And I think it's gone through that stage where, having been ill, having not climbed for a whole year at that time, that it's also okay not to climb, and you can't always be at your best all the time. I mean, there might be some like super wonder kids out there that can be at their best all the time, but at some point you're going to need a break. And then in some ways, I think when you do have a break or you're not always performing at your best, that's when the imposter syndrome kicks in and you're like, oh, should I be doing this? And there's always going to be that element of pressure that you either put on yourself or that comes from sponsorship, where you, if you're not performing at your best all the time, you're like, I should be. And it's learning to branch away from the should and then get into it. It's okay. You're okay to like not be at peak performance all the time. And it will come back. And it usually does come back. It just takes longer sometimes than others.
We're talking about the Lake District. You know, you climb in North Wales. You live in North Wales, right?
Yes, that that's right.
General zone, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so these names in these places have so much connotation for anybody who pays attention to climbing. But maybe we don't understand them here in the States the way we ought to. But so let's go back a little bit and tell me about the Lake District. Like, what's the vibe there, and what was, you know, the vibe that your dad instilled with you, and also incredibly important mentor to you. So tell me about that as your introduction and what that place represents even still.
Oh, well, I mean,
where the heck is it?
So the Lake District is up in the north of the UK. It kind of then borders onto Scotland. It's really beautiful, and it's the home of some of the hardest trad climbing in the UK. You've got the likes of Dave Burkett, who's put up so many of the hard trad routes in the Lake District. And it's a bit of a spread out scene. It's just really beautiful there. I would highly recommend it to anyone who's coming over to visit, apart from the weather, of course. And we moved there when I was very young. I was a baby, and my dad joined the Cockermouth Mountain Rescue Team. And it's all voluntary in the rescue team, and that's how he got into climbing. And so it was through him and his friends like Mike Park who they started to take me out and take me under their wing. And my first trad route, seconding in a full body harness at the age of 7, was a route called Donkey's Ears, which is a diff. So it's kind of just above scrambling territory. And I think I was like half dragged up it at this age. But I think from there, that love of it just grew. And I think by the age of 9, I was seconding routes. Probably by the age of 10, I was starting to lead some of the routes as well. And I think one of the things they instilled in me from a very young age was how to be safe, especially when I was going through the teenage years of advancing quite rapidly and maybe just getting a bit too cocky at certain times, running it out where I shouldn't have been, using dead trees for belays sometimes. And just like all the advice they instilled from a very young age, it's always stuck. And I think another big mentor for me that I was very lucky to grow up with was James McAfee.
Who, right. I have that name down here too.
The Dark Lord, but also one of the best trad climbers in the UK, hands down.
His world.
In the world.
We can just say world.
Yeah, we can say the world. I mean, his on-sighting ability on trad is unreal. I think it's unparalleled. And I was very lucky. I think my dad approached Cap and was like, oh, do you fancy taking this young girl out trad climbing? I think he was about 18 and I would have been about 13 at the time. And Cap always remembers belaying me on my first E1 and me taking falls on it straight away, basically. Or not my first E1 that I led, but one of them. And he just remembers me not being scared. However, my probably closest near-death experience was with Cap as well. And this was me trying to lead my first E4, which was pretty hard territory at the time at the age of 14. And I think this is the piece of advice that now sticks with me that means that I haven't had any serious accidents later in life, was that you don't always have to go for it if you're not feeling it. At the time, I didn't listen to this advice whatsoever. So I got on this E4 after having a not great time on the E1. And Kath remembers that he was watching this 14-year-old girl questing off up on this fairly dirty green trad route, having to use holes that no one else uses. And he just says, I got on the long run out and it looked like I was about to fall off at the end of the run out, with these two guys who were on the E1 to the right of us just teetering sideways on the ledge in case I fell off and went past them or hit them. And he just, he thought I was going to die. And my dad had been at the bottom of the crag watching and he'd walked off. So,
but you didn't. Is that the moral of the story?
The moral, I mean, I'm still here. So I didn't fall off. I managed to get some gear in. And at that point, I made the sensible decision to retreat off the route.
Okay.
And I think it was a near miss that I learned a lot from.
Okay, so it was a near miss that sank in, as opposed to like, whatever, I don't know what you guys were worried about, I was fine. But yeah, you had the internal thought of like, wow, that was a close one.
It definitely was a close one, and a reminder that you're not invincible, basically.
I mean, you couldn't have been very big, he probably could have just caught you, right?
Possibly.
In his arms.
Maybe.
Anyway, but... I mean, let me ask you a little bit then about, let me ask you this about your dad. Your dad like was watching this and like, I got to go. I mean, you know, do you think he ever was like, why did I introduce my sweet girl to this sport that's going to get her killed? You know, did he have his regrets?
You know what? I kind of haven't really asked him what he thought about at that time, but I don't think he has any regrets about introducing me to the sport. I mean, he tried to introduce my brother and sister to climbing as well, but they hate it. So I think it's something that we have a bond over, that we share a love for. And I get to take him out climbing from time to time now when I'm up in the Lake District. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's more harrowing for me, to be honest. I think he now respects my decision making. He may have questioned it from time to time over the years, but he does understand that I know roughly what I'm doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certain he's got to be proud of what you've accomplished as a climber as well. I mean, you know, dreams do come true, sort of a thing. So that's pretty awesome. And yeah, you've managed to get this far without some of the things that can go with running out hard climbing. But let me ask you then a little bit about, you got to like position ourselves before we go any further. With the E scale.
Yes.
And keep in mind that I'm a climbing nerd. I, you know, have been climbing for 30 some years pretty avidly. I study it, I read up at it, and I still don't have a feel for what this grading system is. And I know there's been, you know, a recent little spat of like, do we even know what it means, you know, coming out of the UK anymore? So, and the thing is this, so then I read and I think, you know, I talked about that kind of gulf between us and you guys in a way, because I read, okay, she did this E8 when she was this years old, or she flashed this E, and I'm like, I don't know, is that like 5'10"? Is it awesome or is it not awesome? So can you maybe try to position at least how you think about it when you get in, especially into the hard grades?
Yeah. I mean, it's probably easier to describe it from a hard grades perspective, but
yeah.
Obviously, you've had James Pearson and those guys trying to do the E-grader to make sense of the E-grading British system.
Yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
I'm like, if you guys don't even get it, then how the fuck are we supposed to get it?
It's definitely pretty confusing and messed up. Right. It's really hard to make sense of it. So you basically get your British tech grade, and that can range anywhere from like 3+ to normally like English 7B. The problem is with that British tech grade, you can then get a range of difficulty within that along with the E grade. So I'm going to take a good grade. Let's start at the end of the E grade scale, E1. You could get E1 5A, which means the climbing will be moderately easy, but the gear could be quite terrible. So you're going to get...
Okay, which number talks about the gear and which number talks about the difficulty?
So the E1 grade talks about the gear and the 5A talks about the difficulty. And then that could go into 5B, medium gear, slightly harder tech grade. 5C, harder tech grade, but bomber gear.
Okay.
So that an E1 5C could be like a crack climb that's quite physically hard, but is essentially quite safe because there's lots of gear to place in it.
Okay.
It's really freaking confusing. And then you just get so much variation. Like, I think a classic one is that you can get, I'm going to take a crag in the Lake District, and you get an E6, 6C, and the French sport grade of that is 7C. And then you can get an E8, 6C, and the French grade of that is 8A+.
Okay.
Just as a couple of examples of where the tech grade can fall, and it can. This is where it gets so confusing: is that the French difficulty grade of that can vary so substantially in one English 6E tech grade.
Okay.
And this is why we have confused the hell out of ourselves, basically, with the trad grading system, and no one knows what it means anymore.
Right. And then when you get into like the, you know, the things that have gotten, you know, you and other people, frankly, notoriety, you get up into the E9s and 10s and things like that. And does it always mean that those are relatively scary and dangerous?
Not always. No. Okay. So if I go through a few examples of them, the first ever E9 that I did gets a French grade of 7C. But you wouldn't desperately want to fall off in many places on it. The gear is like tiny, like micro.
What was that? What route was that?
That was Rare Lichen.
Okay.
And it's basically a load of micro, tiny brass offsets that protect you on the first bit. One person has fallen off the top bit and the gear gets slightly bigger then, but not much.
Okay.
Up to something like Big Issue, where the French grade is 8B. Apart from the start, you're pretty safe the entire way. You're just going to take some reasonable falls into space. So it's run out, but safe. And then things like Once Upon a Time in the Southwest, which myself and Anna Hazelnut and Maddie have climbed, it's a lot of like a friable nature of climbing. So the French grade is 8A, but all the gear is quite small and you still get some reasonable run outs. Like, you wouldn't desperately want to fall off it, but you can.
All right. Well, that's a little bit helpful. I mean, you know, it's good enough in my sense to know that the game you're playing, you know, is hard climbing, you know, the French hard climbing or our 5, you know, 13B or whatever those numbers translate to, but on traditional gear and occasionally, as you said, you desperately don't want to fall off, and that's why you get into sort of rehearsal and head pointing and things like that.
Yeah.
And so I mean, it's I guess it's good enough to know that that's like what we're dealing with, and to parse it out anymore probably is almost useless anyway.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that we'll never quite understand.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I wrote down A5 next to this on my thing, and you probably don't know this, but I'm sort of famous for a video that was posted, I mean, over a decade ago, where I slag off those ratings as being kind of stupid and like pointless. And my big point is that A5 like is kind of a joke because we never know, because no one ever falls off of it. You know, supposedly you fall off and you die, but people almost never fall off of it at the wrong time. And so we don't know. And I was wondering, like, well, are E-grades kind of like that? They're like, yeah, if this happened, but we don't really know because no one ever does fall off, kind of a thing. Although then you see the videos of people falling off and like hitting the ground and stuff. So I don't know. I guess it's probably not quite the same thing, but it has that feel of like, it's this idea that we haven't necessarily scientifically tested in any way. It's just a feeling you have when you're on it, kind of a deal.
Yeah, I think there's some routes that obviously have that myth of like, oh, you can't fall off this. And there's some from experience that you know you definitely can't fall off it. And then some like where I guess a big one the last couple of years was Lexicon in the Lake District that Neil Gresham put up. And it was like, you probably don't want to fall off this. But then Steve McClure took the massive ride most of the way down the crag.
Right.
So it's like, oh, you can fall off it, but you still probably don't want to.
Right.
And Rhapsody, yeah. Dave McLeod's one's a classic as well, like E11, but it's just a really big fall. And a lot of people have taken that ride many, many times.
Yeah. I mean, not currently, let's say, you know, because we were just talking about how you're sort of up and down with your trad climbing a little bit. But let's say historically, are you the type of person that's okay with the big ass fall that's not going to hit the ground?
I think so. I mean, I've definitely taken a few reasonable sized falls. I definitely took one of the rides off Big Issue in Pembroke. Yeah, I've definitely taken a few off the trad, but it's been on the safe routes that have been hard, the other one I'm trying at the moment, Mission Impossible, they've definitely taken a few off that as well. But I think it's just there's certain routes where you want to be confident that you're not going to fall and get yourself into that headspace, and then others where you're kind of okay and it's just focusing on trying hard rather than worrying too much about the falls.
Is it historically too, is it easy or not easy? Let's just say this. Is it something that you've always been able to do, like find this quote unquote headspace? Because I think most climbers can't. I mean, if you look at it kind of statistically, this headspace of like, oh, I'm fine. This is really hard, but I'm not going to fall and I can't fall. Is it something you had to train into? Were you sort of like, you know, instilled just by your background in climbing? Where does that quote unquote headspace come from for you, do you think?
I think that headspace comes from a lot of experience and really building up the grades gradually rather than trying to rush anything, just having that experience of learning what a good gear placement looks like. I mean, I guess in that sense it's quite different to a lot of the American climbing, because a lot of American climbing is cam placements and you plug it in and it's like, that is absolutely bomber. Whereas a lot of the UK climbing is really fiddly, weird wires and gear. And you're like, is that bomber? I'm not entirely sure. And so it's just building up that experience of trusting the gear that you're placing, knowing when it's good, knowing when it's not, learning about your no-fall zone. So like whether you're on absolutely bomber rock with a fall into space, or whether you're on some really chossy sea cliff climb that you don't really want to fall off because all the gear is terrible and the rock quality is not great. And so I think just through building up an array of experience on different rock types, it kind of teaches you how to find that headspace pretty quickly. And I think that's where Cass advice comes back in. I know the days when I'm in a good headspace and can push it in that sense, and the days when I'm not, and maybe that's the day I go sport climbing, or another day where I just spend some time working the moves on a route or pick a safe one, basically, that it doesn't matter if I fall off or not.
To me, it is a bit of a superpower, and you may not think of this as that, but it's like, you know, it's really about doubt, right? It's about doubting yourself, doubting, and you know, you can doubt this external thing, this piece of gear, or be confident, but then you also have to have the confidence in your climbing ability, you know, because you don't have to test that piece if you don't fall off. And so if you climb up above it, but you know, for most of us, those doubts instantly start when our feet get above the piece of gear, or even our waist, you know, our harness a little bit. So it's an interesting thing, because it really comes back to that, is like shouting out or calming out those doubts. And I really honestly believe it's a superpower, and you can learn it. Does that headspace, quote unquote, bring you sort of comfort in other parts of your life? Are you able to shake your doubts and other things that you do?
I think sometimes, I guess climbing will always give, if it's going well, will always give me a confidence in life. And when it's not mm-hmm. going well, sometimes I'll right. go into a little bit of a shell and have my self-pity party for a while or for a couple of days. And I think because of like where I've grown up, everything I've done has been in quite a male dominated environment. And so you have to build this mental toughness and kind of just go for it and have confidence. And that won't always be there. Sometimes I'll have question myself and I'll have doubts. I guess a good example of that is when I first got into route setting, and I definitely had doubts about whether I belonged there or not. And my confidence with that goes up and down. I think it definitely impacts, both impact on each other. If life is going well, if I'm in a good place, climbing tends to be going well, and vice versa. And both can impact each other. I think, as hippie-ish as it sounds sometimes, and subconsciously I do it much more in my climbing now, but do it in day-to-day as well, is breath work and practice. And I've got a couple of cracking photos of me actually following through on what I say. And I guess the biggest one that comes in from life into the trad, into staying calm, is the trout pout, or it's the horse lips. And I look back sometimes at the photos that have been taken climbing and go, I actually do what I say.
Oh, right.
And this has been on like extremely run out routes where you kind of don't want to fall, and I'm like, oh, I am doing that trout pout, and there's the O in the lips, where it's like, okay, I am calming myself. And so things that you like do practice at home, not climbing, they work.
and you that's a conscious practice that you do, at least when at home, but then it just comes out unconsciously. Because you've trained yourself when you're on a lead that the rest of us would lose our
pretty
mind.
Much. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's cool.
Yeah, and it's like sometimes yeah. it takes looking back at certain things, or like it actually being captured for you to see that certain things that you do, and like certain things that I coach to other people, it is something that I also do myself. It's not just like do as I say, not as I do.
So, I mean, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, I just called it sort of the superpower and the rarity of it. And also, you know, you've grown up in this world, climbing in general, you know, has always had this sort of there's not parity with women and men, and you get into the trad climbing world, especially when you started, and you become kind of this rare person out there. But before we get into that, I mean, what is it? Do you think that you sort of seek or you demand from this experience of trad climbing, where I feel like, you know, you're this crack sport climber as well. You know, you've climbed 9A, you've climbed 8C in Oleana that I read. I mean, all over the world, all over Europe anyway, you've climbed hard sport climbing, and in the UK. But it almost feels like maybe that's like a break in a way, or like something you do for vacation fun. So what do you seek from this trad climbing? Because most of us just want the vacation fun all the time.
I guess for me, sometimes it is vacation fun on the trad climbing. It's not always not always hard trad.
Perfect. Okay.
And I mean, I guess this is where like some of the alpine stuff comes in, mixed in with the trad, is obviously there's the challenge, but like looking for an aesthetic line, especially if I'm pushing myself, like those probably come to the forefront. But the other side of it is just being outside and being somewhere where there's not many people, It's really tranquil. It's really beautiful. And just getting a moment to actually appreciate where you are. And I think that's the flip side of the other days of Intrad is, or the Alpine, is just getting up high, being in this absolutely beautiful surrounding and having a nice, easy day out with good friends as well. And just also taking other people out, having a nice day with them. And that means that most of the time then my challenge level is reduced, but it's just a day out connecting with a good friend or with my fiance and teaching him more about how to trad climb and how to be safe on British trad. And I think that's also where I find peace, is just in being in the outdoors. I've grown up in the outdoors for most of my life, whether that was out walking from the age of two with my dad or whether it was out climbing. And I think because of going back to my dad, because of him, because of going out walking and because of what he's instilled in me, like this appreciation of nature, like always telling me all about these different birds that we spot on a walk out, telling me about a bit about the history of where we are. And I think that's just like been passed on. And I think I have a lot of appreciation for him instilling that in me, and for me not always wanting to go after a challenge or to be always pushing myself hard. It's just to be out there and appreciating it.
So let me go a little at that question a little bit differently. Is that, you know, we're talking about the breath work and being scared and pushing out doubt. And you talked about how you don't, you know, you have to look back at pictures to realize you were doing it because you've, you know, and we, I think, talk about this in climbing a lot. You've entered this, I think it's a little cliche to say flow state because it's a little bit different than that. That's sort of more of a performance thing. But it is this headspace, to use that phrase again, where you've entered a different kind of level of consciousness, obviously, because you have no memory of these things happening. Your body was just doing it. Is that, I mean, do you find yourself, you know, reflecting on like seeking those sorts of things that you get, again, you know, the fear or the risk or whatever you want to say is an ingredient in this feeling that I think drag climbers, and I look at like, you know, your friend James Calf, you know, and I think of someone like that, I'm like, God, he's got to be addicted to it at this point. So where do you think about that and sort of seeking those situations that other people, literally like 99.9% of the population of the world, avoid? I mean, we do. We our whole lives are about avoiding that kind of fear and risk. And it makes climbers like you and climbing in general sort of special that way.
That's definitely a conversation that me and Kaf have had. I mean, I've watched Kaf at a young age go soloing a lot, much to my parents' disappointment and worry. I think they see him as like a second, an extra son almost. And I think it used to scare the hell out of them. And he doesn't solo as much anymore as he's getting older because the risk versus the reward has reduced and there's more fear there. And I think that's something inevitably as I've got older I'm noticing as well, is that now I'm in my late 30s, the desire to go out and constantly do that isn't there as much as maybe it was a couple of years ago. And so it's more just about having maybe one or two projects that do that, and knowing that my mental capacity to do that many times isn't there as much as it was. And so I do find myself trending more towards the hard, safe trad routes now than perhaps I did before. And I think that is a choice that I'm aware of, definitely over the last couple of years. And I just think it's inevitable that the desire to seek risk does diminish a little bit, especially as you have more responsibilities and there's other people involved and you have to make sensible choices.
Yeah, wait till you become a mom.
Yeah.
sounds like that's something you're looking forward to, but even as a dad, and this is totally different, but yeah, I'm scared of everything now. So
it becomes, I guess, kind of a it becomes quite selfish. And that's not to say it wasn't selfish before, because it is. Like one wrong decision or a hole breaking, and that could be completely life changing. And that doesn't just impact me. It impacts your family. It can impact close friends. And it's like, well, yeah, what we do is very selfish in some respects. And I think it's nice that it's admired, but it's also like there is like this narcissistic side to it as well. And yes, I think it's also there to be like, well, is that risk and reward versus reward, is it truly worth it? For the most part, we get away with it, but it doesn't take much for that to go wrong.
I kind of want to talk about women in track climbing and women in climbing in general, because, you know, you represent a little bit of a small cohort at the levels that you're doing it. But maybe a way to do that would be to talk a little bit about North Wales climbing. You know, we talked about the Lake District, and then North Wales is this whole other animal, so to speak. And again, it comes with like tons of different imagery and myths that, you know, it's like sometimes I think it's like just like any other climbing scene. And sometimes I think it's like, you know, I don't know, like Lord of the Rings and the orcs, you know, scaling the walls of Helm's Deep or whatever, you know, there's like, who knows? And like deep, dark pubs are super important. Lots of drinking is like, these are all things I think about when terrible weather. I think that's spot on.
Lots of cafes.
Yeah. And lots of scary, horrible routes. And that also I know not to be entirely true. So tell me a little bit about the North Wales scene that you're deep into. And, you know, you probably have been deeper in it at times and maybe push it away a little bit at other times. So tell me a little bit about this storied, I mean, as storied a climbing scene as the world knows, really.
I mean, I guess like one of the things with UK track climbing in general is just the history of it is so rich, and that's nothing different in North Wales. There's all these like myths and legends surrounding routes in North Wales, and that's what makes, I think, British trad climbing so special, is just this rich history and all these characters, especially back in the like 70s and 80s. And so the North Wales scene is pretty vibrant. It's a bit more close-knit, slightly less spread out than the Lake District. Funnily enough, James McAfee also lives in North Wales now. So he's like,
no, that's the, that makes complete sense. Yeah.
And
it's where you go for those sorts of things.
Yeah. I think particularly if you've grown up in the mountains, that North Wales is the next one that makes sense. I mean, I obviously spent time in the Peak District in Sheffield as well at university, but North Wales made more sense for me in the long run. So when I first moved to North Wales, I was going out bouldering a lot, very different to trad climbing. And I would go out a lot with some of the strong guys, and I would be the only girl going out bouldering with them. This is despite there being a lot of strong women in North Wales. And I think I asked some of them once, I was like, why aren't you coming out with us? And they said, we just don't feel good enough. And I was like, well, that's ridiculous. You're all bouldering like V8. You're easily strong enough to be out, and it doesn't really matter. Everyone will go somewhere that's good for everyone. It made me stronger just by going out with them and having to get on with it. And now the women's bouldering scene is fantastic. And you find more strong women going out climbing than boys half the time. And we've had events like Women of Wales recently at one of the climbing walls. And it's really come to the forefront a lot more, but it's taken a decade of me being here for that to happen. And that's even less in trad climbing and sport climbing. There's a handful, and hopefully that will increase because you see more women out and about that are climbing and climbing well. And whether that's me or whether that's someone else, and you look at who's relatable and who's where you can make your achievements. And I think it's just getting that to trickle down, basically. Bouldering's more easily accessible and less terrifying, so it's the one where it's come to the forefront a lot more.
Can be,
unless you're going on some crazy highballs.
Well, you know, I've thought about this whole idea of like, you know, accessibility of climbing. It's such a an issue of our times, you know, trying to open and encourage climbing in different economic groups, different, you know, ethnic backgrounds, whatever, different colors of skin, all these different things. It really is like the prominent issue at the moment. And trying to invite more women into the sport has been something we've done for a decade pretty actively as well. I always had this attitude that I found climbing when I had found this like secret thing. And like a child, I wanted it to be secret. It was mine, you know, and this is, say, 30 years ago. And I didn't care who else found it. I just assumed they didn't, you know. And I think about, like, bring, you know, sort of encouraging women or anyone, for that matter, into this kind of track climbing that we've been sort of talking about. Again, there's track climbing that's totally safe. Like you said, in the States, you know, crack climbing, which I think is more specific but fits the bill, is completely safe if done well and done right. But sort of encouraging people to join you in this kind of world where things get scary, it seems a little fraught in the sense of, like, it may be something where you encourage people to find climbing, and then this is one area of the sport that maybe it has to just happen organically or naturally, because it would be terrible to encourage somebody to be like, yeah, you should really get into this and try that, and then have something happen and sort of have that, like, as do you know what I'm saying, almost like you're a parent, you know, like I was asking about your dad walking away from that horrible trad lead, like wondering, like, did I just, you know, has the path led to this and this is where it ends, kind of a thing. So I mean, what are your thoughts on that as far as, like, the specificness of the type of climbing that we've been sort of chatting about being maybe one of those areas that you have to find it in yourself to a certain extent?
I think it has to be quite an organic choice to some extent. And obviously, going to the accessibility side of it, trad is the most, one of the more inaccessible sides of it. You've got so much more gear to buy for a starter, or you've got to know the right people to get into it, or you've just got to have that desire that you actually want to trad climb and make those risks. Those risks, and for a lot of people, as you said, that's not something that many people want to do. And so I think it's just someone's got to make that informed choice for themselves, and you can't push someone to want to do that. Like, my dad couldn't push my brother or my sister to get into climbing, and that's a choice that they made versus the choice that I made, that I did want to go all the way and basically take the risks. And so I think it's just like listening out, and if someone's keen, do you take them under your wing, or do you point them in the right direction of a course with an experienced instructor? We have many in the UK that do all that sort of stuff. And I'm about to start trying to do my awards so that I can do more coaching and instructing work in the future. Mm-hmm. And I've got one girl who's a teenager who lives all the way in the southwest of the UK, so doesn't have that much tri climbing opportunity, but she loves it. And so I've been taking her under my wing a little bit and taking her out tri climbing. And it feels like I'm a responsible parent for someone else's kid at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was wondering. Yeah, totally. That was not totally what I was wondering. Like, okay, here we go.
Yeah, it's so obviously some of the stuff that I've done with her, it's been making sure that she understands her placements on the rock, having a top rope back up and a mum belaying her, like getting her to like sit on gear, like learn to fall on it, but all backed up safely. And I think the big one for me was when we just went for a day's climbing together by ourselves. And I took her on a classic sea cliff climb. But it's something I made a character judgment over. She's got a very level head for her age, very mature. Were there things that could have been done slightly differently? Possibly. But at some point, you also have to, like, give that person respect and trust them and show that you respect that they know what they're doing. And I think that's something that my dad and Kath and everyone gave to me, was a respect that from a young age, I could make those decisions. And yes, I would sometimes get them wrong, but I would learn from them at the same time. And so it's just going with what someone wants to do, and whether they want to try a climb or not, so be it. If they want a sport climb, or if they just want to boulder, like, that's all good. Like, go and do what makes you happy, basically.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you were sort of like stepping into a mentor role. It's almost like you got to pay it back in some ways, right? Because so many people, you know, we talked about a few of them in here have helped you along that way. And, you know, and I think the scene can be super discouraging, I think, probably. You know, it's like, are you ready? You know, who's this little girl that's showing up to do these hard roots kind of a thing? I don't know if you've ever encountered that at all. Yeah. Back in your past.
100%. I think you inevitably get it at some point, particularly in the Lake District. Back when I was a kid, and I mean, this is too many years ago now. Yeah, people would look at me as this young girl coming up and be like, "Oh, what's she doing?" Or that must be easy because there's like a teenage girl on it. Yeah. And I think it used to frustrate me a little bit. And I mean, I got it when I was an adult and living in Sheffield as well. Maybe not on the trad, but if I was at the Wall, like some guys would just come up afterwards and get on what you get on, thinking it's going to be easy. And the satisfaction comes from the fact that they get completely shut down on it.
Burned off.
Burned off. And so it's just like, well, yeah, more fool you, basically.
Right. That's awesome. Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I've talked to Hazel a few times, consider a friend. And, you know, it sounds like there was quite a bit of parallel sort of action between the two of you guys.
I think
as far as her coming up in it as well with her dad.
I think because we both started on trad at probably, I mean, she's a few years younger than me, but probably in a similar era, is that you did. There was a lot more of that. I think now there's a bit more understanding that there are lots of strong female climbers out there. Mm-hmm. And so there's less of an expectancy to, like, you're going to see these female crushes and maybe have an appreciation more of what they're getting on could be quite hard, or on trad routes as well. But yeah, I think definitely myself and Hazel probably both experienced that a lot when we were younger, and this like unassuming young teenage girls rocking up and just getting on some crazy trad routes.
Yeah, that sounds, I mean, it sounds cool is what it sounds. I mean, just like anytime, you know, what I always say when people smash the state, it's cool. And that's like puts things forward in a lot of ways. So, you know, you mentioned like this cohort that, did Once Upon a Time in the Southwest, that, you know, came to our again over here across the pond, you know, purview with Hazel's Ascent and then with Anna Hazelnuts. Was it interesting to you that sort of this outsider came in and did something like that? Because I think that's a little bit unusual. Well, and I say outsider not in some sort of evil sense, but someone who didn't come up in that scene. You know, you guys have the background, the history. It's all in your cells, you know, it's like in your DNA. And I think it's a little bit unusual. I mean, even with men, it's been noted for years when you know, a Frenchie, as it were, comes over back in the day and pisses everybody off by, you know, sending something hard. I mean, maybe not trap, but I'm thinking of like, you know, Antoine Le Ministral.
Yeah.
You know, comes in and sends Jerry's route, like, you know, naked in the rain or something like that, free solo. And so yeah, what was your thoughts on her, and do you know Anna?
Yeah, I've met Anna in Spain, and yeah, she's lovely. She's definitely a character, as we would say in the UK. It was interesting and it was refreshing at the same time, because it's nice for these things to get attention and for someone from outside to come and try it and be like, oh, this is, it was a pretty wild introduction, I think, for her. I mean, she had Tom mentoring her. I think one of the crazy things for me was seeing them taking so many falls on this route. I think maybe where it was kind of like, oh, this feels crazy, is having had so little previous trad experience. I think one thing you could say for myself and Hazel we've had like a very gradual build up and understanding of gear placements and falling on trad. So, I mean, it was kind of pretty wild to see it all unfold, basically. And I do have a lot of respect for the fact that she just went balls deep in, basically, and just got on with it. And it was like, I think for me, like, And I've seen it with a lot of young British trad climbers as well. Like, the new generation is like, it's got to happen now. It's got to be quick. There's no build up and no real understanding. And I think that's where it came in. Like, there was no real understanding of gear placements, like going on sighting, really learning to trusty gear. And I think for me, I was like, I sometimes question the full understanding of the trad gear placements, like what to fall on, what not to fall on. But that did come through in her videos as well. She was like, yeah, this placement that I placed, Tom said it's terrible or whatever. And I was just like, whew, that's pretty, I mean, it's pretty ballsy at the same time. I was just like, my mind was blown a little bit, basically. But I also have like respect for just going after it.
I've been talking to some folks here in the States, because there's a bunch of, you just mentioned sort of young people coming up into this thing, and you know, there's several examples here in the States of some pretty young dudes in particular, in this case guys, that are just like, you know, coming out of the gates trad climbing. You know, this sort of generation of people who've grown up in the gym are like hitting the hard routes now in the outdoors, and I had this notion that like, there's this tradition and this thing that it's all in your DNA, but there's also this sort of freedom if you can get around the risk part of it, the sort of ignorance part of it, I guess, of not having the baggage, you know, and not on, you know, this person I'm talking about that way, I just interviewed for another podcast, Will Moss, is a 19-year-old, and he learned how to trad climb, and then I think he said he led like a 5.3 and then a 5.6, and then he led this, you know, this 12 in the Gunks, was his third trad lead, you know. And I was also similarly like, what the fuck, like, dude. But then talking to him, like, his approach is very logical, and he didn't really cut corners in the sense of like understanding the gear, but he cut all the traditional corners, which he was supposed to climb 5.8 for a year and then 5.9 for a year. And then, you know, he just went straight to it. And are you seeing any of that kind of thing in your area, as far as these kids that are so strong and then they kind of like figure out gear and it's
yeah. I think there's definitely been a bit of it over the years. Maybe my view of it is quite old, or like the way I was brought into it now, it was quite old fashioned, the like build up gradually. Mm-hmm. But I think also back then,
me too. Yeah.
There was more of the leader mustn't fall. And so you're kind of like that was ingrained from a young age. And then you suddenly realize that you can fall actually, and it's totally fine. But I mean, depending on the route, obviously. But
I think a
classic one for me back in the day was like, or not that long ago, was Jim Pope. And he's like ridiculously strong, but I think one of his first trad routes was like an E6 head point. And I can't quite remember that, probably where that equates into in American grades, but it's pretty serious. Like there's not much gear on that. So it's basically a solo to the top, and then you place one bit of gear. And so he'd like top roped it and then led it. And so back then I thought about that and I was like, well, that hasn't really taught you anything about trad climbing or like what gear is. But then he's gone on to lead some really hard routes and become an impressive trad climber in the last few years for sure, on top of the comp climbing. Another big one has been a guy called Matt Wright in the UK. And he really hadn't done much trad climbing, but has sport climbed 9A and then came along and led Lexicon as probably one of his early trad routes. And so I think it's just like, you look at it now, there's more people training, there's more strong people. Inevitably, they're going to come in at much harder grades on trad and just be so much more capable of having enough in the tank to lead them, and for it not to be as sketchy or as dangerous as someone who's maybe only sport climbing like 7C and they're trying at the limit on a trad route. I just think there's just so, people have just got so much more fitness now and so much more strength.
Yeah, it kind of comes down to that. Like I said, if you don't need to worry about the gear if you never fall off.
If you're so far beneath your limit in terms of the physicality of the route, then yeah. I mean, there's this ridiculous video, I don't know if you've seen it, of Jim Pope on a trad route where I think his foot pops and it's on a grit route. It's a pretty dangerous grit route as well. And he basically just one arm lock off campuses up on this grit route. And I'm like, There's no one else who'd be able to do that. I mean, or there's very few people who'd be able to do that. And you're just watching it going, this is nuts.
He just did it. He just did it for the
It's just for the Instagram likes.
Right. Yeah. I'm gonna pretend my foot pops here on these jugs and go to the top. Well, that's interesting. I mean, it's like I said, there's so much tradition and in a lot of ways there's been, you know, these rites of passage that people sort of had to do. I mean, the same in any climbing scene, so to speak. But when you throw in these sort of you know, when you throw in the these risky routes, the mythology and the legends are, I mean, you don't have those kind of legends about, like, you know, an 8B somewhere, sport climb somewhere. There's just so much power and package that comes with that. I think it must be fascinating just to kind of watch, you know, again, people break those rules and get around them and do things that, you know, were impossible even a few years ago.
I think
ago.
It's where the future of climbing, whether that's tri climbing or not, is going. I mean, actually speaking to Hazel and Angus recently, they were in Saint-Léger and they said they were at this crag where I think the French kids team had turned up and half of them were like on sighting 8B and 8C. And it was like a daily regular occurrence. And they were just like, this is ridiculous. But then, I mean, perhaps controversially, because of all this history, because of all the traditionalism in the UK, maybe that's also like slowed down that progression. And now we're getting to that and you're seeing what is possible.
But, you know, the great thing, I mean, the thing I've always admired about climbing there is this, you know, the fact that you guys do, I use the word ring, but I like, you ring so much out of like the rock that you have, the conditions that you have. You know, we just talked to Will Bosey and he was talking about having to, you know, go hours and hike hours to this 9A in Scotland, the Hunger, I think it was called, you know. Yeah, and just like what he had to go through to do it, and I think it's led to, again, just so much lore and so much kind of grit, to use the pun, out of UK climbers that, I mean, the world admires you guys in this very special way that we don't apply to anybody else in the world.
It's this like weird stubborn resilience, I think. In that you just have to make the most of it when it comes. And do all these crazy hikes to routes and hope that you get to do it quickly. And if not, it's going to be a long epic, basically, of hiking again and again and again, and or just being shut down for the rest of the year because it rains.
Well, we rearranged this interview a little bit because you were like, we have a good forecast.
Yeah.
I want to go climbing. And I was like, no problem. I know those don't come around a lot. And then you mentioned how, well, we didn't quite, and then you got soaked anyway.
Yeah. Right? We had a good 2.5, maybe 3 hours of dry weather. Unfortunately, my friend had actually set off on lead on the route as it came in on us. Luckily, he fell off, probably because I don't think he'd have been able to top out the route. It was just all starting to come over. And then, yeah, we got drenched. It was a good skin soaking, basically. And it's like that a lot. It's either really humid, really midgy, really wet, too hot. We like to complain as well. The conditions are never right.
Oh, that's okay. I live on the western slope where it's dry, like dry and sunny, like you know, can't even dream about because it's unattainable, and we still complain. So don't we still complain? But so you were a excellent youth climber. You switched gears, but you're also a route setter now.
Yes.
And so one of the things that's interesting, and I think it is part of, again, what we were just talking about with climbing, kind of limits on climbing availability in some ways, is that, you know, I think, and this has changed some, but there's been a lot of like one trackness in climbing where you're a track climber and you don't sport climb or you don't climb indoors or whatever. And it seems, you know, for a long, long time, UK climbers, Sheffield climbers, you know, are famous in particular for really embracing training and also embracing sort of plastic climbing when necessary and things like that. Do you still kind of feel like that built a base for you that you still call upon? And then how did you get into root setting as this supposed trad climber?
So I think when I was younger, because outdoors was my first love, I would be one of those probably com climbers that didn't really train in the summer because it's too nice to be indoors. But I also think that definitely did help me, with like a bit of mental toughness. I definitely had anxiety when I was competing, and I learned how to deal with that from a very young age and how to control it. I think it also helped me because I had people to compete against to push me. And one of my big rivals when I was competing as a young age was a girl called Gemma Powell. And she got training from the GB coach at the time. And so it really pushed me to get better. So I was like following her in her footsteps, basically. And I think, I mean, I also did a lot of other sports when I was younger. Like I did a lot of fell running, and that I think has helped me a lot with my climbing, particularly the endurance side of it and being able to hang on forever, which is useful in trad. I think I had a love-hate relationship with competitions, and they definitely weren't very much fun anymore after having glandular fever, or mono as it's called, because I basically took a complete year out of climbing, focused on my A-levels, which is just before university, and decided that that obviously was more important at the time. I think the love for competition climbing never came back after that, really. And maybe that's an ego thing. I'd gone from doing pretty well just before I got ill to having to start from scratch, basically. And I just think it never fully recovered for me, that enjoyment of comp climbing. And so it wasn't too difficult a choice to give that up and focus on the outdoors. But when I was in Sheffield and trying to decide what I wanted to do with my life, I don't know whether this is the right, a good decision or a bad decision, it became route setting. And so I think, like, having climbed from a young age, having a good understanding of movement, having competed, it all helped me in that sense. And I have been route setting now for 10 years or 11 years. It takes its toll. But it also, as long as you don't get injured, it is a good base for climbing and training. I wouldn't say I get much training in on top of route setting. It's very much a case of being flexible and listening to my body in that sense, and picking days when I can train and accepting there are days I can't train.
Is that still a big motivation for you? Or has it ever been? Some people like live almost to train, you know, and the climbing is like a side. Like, where do you fit on that spectrum of hating it and not wanting it to do it to being obsessed with it? Are you somewhere in the middle?
I've definitely always mostly been a climber's climber, and seen climbing right. is the best form of training, and being outdoors is the most important thing for me. I think obviously you get everyone has different loves in the sport, and some people just love training. I think I find it hard to do training that isn't climbing, basically, but I will do right. it. And I've definitely found it to be particularly useful when I can't climb on top of like the setting, or I don't want to do anything else that's going to hinder climbing outside. And I guess the fingerboard is my biggest area of training that I get to utilize most frequently. Mm-hmm. One of the things, maybe I can relate to the party on this one, is doing a bit more of the antagonistic and weight training stuff. But I've also found that is probably one of the things that impacts my next day of route setting the most as well. Especially if it's a really physical day, it feels really hard to set the next day. It's just like being sensible with it as much as anything. And maybe if I wasn't setting, maybe I'd be training a lot more. But I am route setting, and so it's just kind of being smart with it as much as anything. It's having a guideline rather than having a rigid training plan. Like, I know what I want to do, and I got that from doing my degree, but I can't always be rigid with it. I can't be like, you've got to train this day, this day, this day. It just doesn't work like that with the route setting industry at the same time.
It speaks to just putting all these puzzle pieces together that it takes to perform at the level that you've been able to perform at, and will continue to pursue those kind of goals. But yeah, I mean, the puzzle piece thing, you know, is something that I sort of hearing about through this whole interview in a lot of ways. I mean, you mentioned, you know, wanting to have kids. You're about to get married, so you're starting a family on both levels. You've been at this a long time. You have financial needs, obviously. I don't know if root setting is making you rich. No. I doubt it. You've got degrees. I mean, you're coming into a time in life that I think so many climbers face when you have all these puzzle pieces and you still want to perform and you still want to enjoy climbing. So how do you think about the next few years and fitting all these puzzle pieces together? And have you thought about it at all? Are you daunted by it? Are you excited?
I'm a bit of both. I think I'm daunted and excited because it's always going to be a bit of a level of the unknown, which you deal with in climbing on sighting anyway. And I think, yes, I think I see probably an end or a reduction in the amount of resetting I'm doing. It's not viable as a long-term career for much longer. I love it. It's why I still do it. And so I'd never want to not completely do it. But my current setup and a lot of the work that I do, it's in London and I live in North Wales. So it's like a five hour journey. And so, yeah, if I want to start a family, that's not a viable option, basically. And yeah, it's something that we've thought about a lot is, well, like I'll probably look to get more into the coaching side of it. And we have our a psychology company that we've been setting up over the last year called Climbing Flow, because that's a side of climbing that really interests me as well. And there's never a bit of me in climbing that isn't going to want to perform. I'm that sort of a person that I will always want to push myself, whatever that level becomes. I don't know right now. But if we have kids, that will change. And I think it's one of the things that I've really paid attention to and found a lot of inspiration in recently is all the female climbers that have, all the badass female climbers that have been having kids, like Paige Klassen and Emily Harrington, and looking at their journeys to come back, and it is possible. So whilst there'll be some time out, it's like never say never to coming back to performing at some level or another. And I think also having come in from a young age, it's like you get to be happy with whatever you're doing. And as long as I'm outside climbing, I'm going to be happy. And then it's just figuring out what parts of life work with that as well, what works career-wise, like what my partner does, and yeah, where it all goes in the future from there, like whether we have kids or not, whether that's successful or not, because there is that possibility. And you have to, I guess you have to be accepting of whatever outcome happens, basically.
All right, folks, thanks for listening. And thank you to Emma for sitting down, making that happen. That was cool. She's cool. I think she's cool. And of course, you could and should follow Emma Twyford on Instagram at Emma Twyford. She got it. She's the only one. Of course, Googling Emma brings up all sorts of videos, some of big whippers. Pretty exciting. All right, last thing is I'm thinking about going to Lander, the International Climbing Festival, but I haven't quite decided. I missed out last year. I was in Europe. I know, boo-hoo. But I did have some FOMO. A lot of history up there with the Enormacast and the International Climbers Festival in Lander in July sometime. I don't know the dates. But if you're thinking about going, let me know. Maybe it'll tip the scales. Me and you hanging out in Lander might be enough to get me there. Because you're so special. Get out there. Have some fun. Don't forget to check your knots.
It is King Arthur, and these are my knights of the Round Table. Whose castle is this?
This is the castle of my master, Guido Luamba.
Go and tell your master that we have been charged by God with a sacred quest. If he will give us food and shelter for the night, he can join us in our quest for the Holy Grail.
Well, I'll ask him, but I don't think he'll be very keen. He's already got one, you see?
What? He says they've already got one. Are you sure he's got one?
Oh, yes, it's very nice.
I told him we already got one. Well, can we come up and have a look?
Of course not. You are English types.
Well, what are you then?
I'm French. Why do you think I have this outrageous accent, you silly king?
What are you doing in England?
Mind your own business.